the corner of his eye, at the last moment. The last moment is not always too late, but this time it was. Ginelli slipped the belt around his neck and pulled it tight. There was a short struggle. The young gypsy dropped his shotgun and clawed at the belt. The earphones slid down his cheeks, and Ginelli could hear the rolling stones sounding lost between the stars, singing, "Under My Thumb." The young man began to make choked, gargling noises. His struggles weakened, then stopped entirely. Ginelli kept the pressure on for another 20 seconds, and then relaxed it. "I didn't want to make him foolish," he explained seriously to Billy, and dragged him up the hill and into the underbrush. He was a good-looking, well-muscled man of perhaps 22, wearing jeans and dingo boots. Ginelli guessed from Billy's description that it was Samuel Lemke, and Billy agreed. Ginelli found a good-sized tree and used strapping tape to bind him to it. "It sounds stupid, saying you taped somebody to a tree, but only if you never had it done to you. Enough of that shit wound around you, and you might as well forget it. Strapping tape is strong. You're going to be where you are until someone comes along and cuts you loose. You can't break it, and you sure as shit can't untie it." Ginelli cut off the bottom half of Lemke's T-shirt, stuffed it into his mouth, and taped it in place. "Then I turned over the cassette in his machine and stuck the phones back on his head. I didn't want him to be too bored when he woke up." Ginelli now walked up the side of the road. He and Lemke were of similar height, and he was willing to take the risk that he would be able to stroll right up to another sentry before being challenged. Besides, it was getting late, and he'd had no sleep but 2 short naps in the last 48 hours. "Miss enough sleep, and you goof up," he said. "If you're playing Monopoly, that's all right. But if you're dealing with fuckers that shoot people and then write discouraging words on their foreheads in chicken blood, you're apt to die. As it happens, I did make a mistake. I was lucky enough to get away with it. Sometimes God forgives." The mistake was not seeing the second sentry until he was walking past him. It happened because the second man was well back in the shadows instead of standing at the edge of the road, as Lemke had been doing. Lucky for Ginelli, the reason was not concealment, but comfort. "This one wasn't just listening to a Walkman," Ginelli said. "This one was fast asleep. Lousy guards, but about what you'd expect from civilians. Also, they hadn't made up their minds that I was serious long-term trouble for them yet. If you think someone is seriously on the prod for your ass, that keeps you awake. Man, that keeps you awake even when you want to go to sleep." Ginelli walked over to the sleeping guard, picked his spot on the guard's skull, and then applied the butt of the Kalashnikov to that spot with a fair amount of force. There was a thud like the sound of a limp hand striking a mahogany table. The guard, who had been propped comfortably against a tree, fell over in the grass. Ginelli bent and felt for a pulse. It was there, slow, but not erratic. He pressed on. 5 minutes later, he came to the top of a low hill. A sloping field opened out and down on the left. Ginelli could see the dark circle of vehicles parked about 200 yards from the road. No campfire tonight. Dim, curtain-screened lights in a few of the campers, but that was all. Ginelli worked his way halfway down the hill on his belly and his elbows, holding the assault rifle out in front of him. He found a rock outcropping that allowed him to both seat the stock firmly and to sight down the hill to the encampment. The moon was just coming up, but I wasn't going to wait for it. Besides, I could see well enough for what I had to do. By then I was no more than 75 yards from them, and it wasn't as if I had to do any fine work. Kalashnikov's no good for that anyway. Might as well try to take out a guy's appendix with a chainsaw. Kalashnikov's good to scare people with. I scared them all right. I bet just about all of them made lemonade in the sheets. But not the old man. He's as tough as they come, William. With the automatic rifle firmly set, Ginelli pulled in a deep breath and sighted on the front tire of the unicorn camper. There was the sound of crickets and a small stream babbling somewhere close by. A whippoorwill cried out once across the dark field. Halfway through its second verse, Ginelli opened fire. The Kalashnikov's thunder ripped the night in two. Fire hung around the end of the barrel in a corona as the clip, 30 .30 caliber bullets, each in a casing almost as long as a king-size cigarette, each powered with 140 grains of powder, ran out. The unicorn camper's front tire did not just blow. It exploded. Ginelli raked the bellowing gun the length of the camper, but lo, didn't put a single goddamn hole in the body, he said. Tore the hell out of the ground beneath it. Didn't even cut it close because of the gas tank. Ever see a camper blow? It's like what happens when you light a firecracker and put a can over it. I saw it happen once on the New Jersey Turnpike. The camper's back tire blew. Ginelli popped the first clip and slammed another one in. The uproar was beginning below. Voices yelled back and forth, some angry, most just scared. A woman screamed. Some of them, how many of the total number Ginelli had no way of telling, were spilling out of the backs of campers, mostly in pajamas and nightgowns, all looking confused and scared, all trying to stare in five different directions at the same time. And then Ginelli saw Tadeusz Lemke for the first time. The old man looked almost comic in his billowing nightshirt. Straggles of hair were escaping from beneath his tasseled nightcap. He came around the front of the unicorn van, took one look at the flattened, twisted tires, and then looked directly up toward where Ginelli was lying. He told Billy that there was nothing comic in that burning glance. "I knew he couldn't see me," he said. "The moon wasn't up. I had lampblack on my face and hands. I was just another shadow in a whole field of them. But I think he did see me, William, and it cooled off my heart." The old man turned toward his people, who were beginning to drift in his direction, still babbling and waving their hands. He shouted at them in Rome and swept an arm at the caravan. Ginelli didn't understand the language, but the gesture was clear enough. "Get under cover, you fools." "Too late, William," Ginelli said smugly. He had loosed the second burst directly into the air over their heads. Now a lot of people were screaming, men as well as women. Some hit the ground and began to crawl, most of them with their heads down and their butts waving in the air. The rest ran, breaking in all directions but the one from which the fire had come. Lemke stood his ground, bellowing at them, bull-throated. His nightcap fell off. The runners went on running, the crawlers crawling. Lemke might ordinarily rule them with an iron hand, but Ginelli had panicked them. The Pontiac station wagon from which he had taken the coat and sneakers the night before was parked next to the van, nose out. Ginelli slammed a third clip into the AK-47 and opened fire again. "There wasn't anyone in it last night, and the way it smelled, I guessed no one would be in it tonight either. I killed that station wagon. I mean, I annihilated that motherfucker." "An AK-47 is a very mean gun, William. People who have only seen war movies think that when you use a machine gun or an automatic rifle, you end up with this neat little line of holes. But it ain't like that. It's messy, it's hard, and it happens fast. The windshield of that old Bonneville blew in. The hood popped up a little. Then the bullets caught it and tore it right off. The headlights blew, the tires blew, the grill fell off. I couldn't see the water spraying out of the radiator. It was too dark for that. But when the clip ran out, I could sure hear it. When the clip ran out, that son of a bitch looked like it had run into a brick wall. And during all of it, while the glass and chrome were flying, that old man never moved. Just looked for the muzzle flash so he could send the troops after me if I was stupid and waited for him to get his troops together. I decided to split before he could." Ginelli ran for the road, bent over low like a World War II soldier advancing under fire. Once there, he straightened up and sprinted. He passed the inner perimeter sentry, the one he had used the gun butt on, with hardly a glance. But when he reached the spot where he had taken Mr. Walkman, he stopped, catching his breath. "Finding him wasn't hard, even in the dark," Ginelli said. "I could hear the underbrush shaking and crackling. When I got a little closer, I could hear him, too. Lemke had actually worked his way a quarter of the way around the tree he had been taped to, the net result being that he was more tightly bound than ever. The earphones had fallen off and were dangling around his neck by their wires. When he saw Ginelli, he stopped struggling and just looked. I saw in his eyes that he thought I was going to kill him, and that he was good and fucking scared, Ginelli said. That suited me just fine. The old dude wasn't scared, but I'll tell you, that kid wishes sincerely that they had never fucked with you, William. Unfortunately, I couldn't really make him sweat. There wasn't time. He knelt down by Lemke and held up the AK-47 so Lemke could see what it was. Lemke's eyes showed that he knew perfectly well. I don't have much time, asshole, so listen good, Ginelli said. You tell the old man that next time I won't be shooting high or low or at empty cars. Tell him William Halleck says to take it off. You got that? Lemke nodded as much as the tape would allow. Ginelli tore it off his mouth and pulled the ball of shirting free. It's gonna get busy around here, Ginelli said. You yell, they'll find you. Remember the message. He turned to go.
You don't understand, Lemke said hoarsely. He'll never take it off. He's the last of the great Magyar chiefs. His heart is a brick. Please, mister, I'll remember. But he'll never take it off.
On the road, a pickup truck went bucketing by toward the gypsy camp. Ginelli glanced in that direction and then back at Lemke. Bricks can be crushed, he said. Tell him that, too. Ginelli broke out to the road again, crossed it, and jogged back toward the gravel pit. Another pickup truck passed him, then three cars in a line. These people, understandably curious about who had been firing an automatic weapon in their little town in the dead of night, presented no real problem for Ginelli. The glow of the approaching headlights allowed him plenty of time to fade back into the woods each time. He heard an approaching siren just as he ducked into the gravel pit. He started the Nova up and rolled it dark to the end of the short access line. A Chevrolet with a blue bubble on the dashboard roared by. After it was gone, I wiped the crap off my face and hands and followed it, Ginelli said.
Followed it? Billy broke in.
Safer. If they're shooting, innocent people break their legs getting to it, so they can see some blood before the cops come and hose it off the sidewalk. People going in another direction are suspicious. Lots of times they are leaving because they've got guns in their pockets.
By the time he reached the field again, there were half a dozen cars parked along the shoulder of the road. Headlight beams crisscrossed each other. People were running back and forth and yelling.
The constable's car was parked near the spot where Ginelli had sat the second young man. The bubble light on the dash whipped flickers of blue across the trees. Ginelli unrolled the Nova's window.
What's up, officer?
Nothing to worry about. Move along. And just in case the fella in the Nova might speak English but only understand Russian, the constable whipped his flashlight impatiently in the direction Finson Road was going. Ginelli rolled slowly on up the road, threading his way between the parked vehicles, the ones that belonged to the local folks, he guessed. It was maybe harder for you to move along gawkers who were your neighbors, he told Billy. There were two distinct knots of people in front of the station wagon Ginelli had shot up. One comprised gypsy men in pajamas and nightshirts. They were talking among themselves, some of them gesticulating extravagantly. The other comprised town men. They stood silently, hands in pockets, gazing at the wreck of the station wagon. Each group ignored the other. Finson Road continued on for 6 miles, and Ginelli almost ditched the car not once but twice as people came barreling along what was little more than a dirt track at high speed.
Just guys out in the middle of the night hoping to see a little blood before the cops hosed it off the sidewalk, William. Or off the grass, in this case.
He connected with a feeder road that took him into Bucksport, and from there he turned north. He was back in the John Tree Motel room by 2 in the morning. He set the alarm for 7:30 and turned in.
Billy stared at him.
You mean that all the time I was worrying that you were dead, you were sleeping in the same motel we left?
Well, yeah.
Gianelli looked ashamed of himself for a moment, and then he grinned and shrugged at the same time.
Put it down to an experience, William. I am not used to people worrying about me. Except my mama, of course, and that is different.
You must have overslept. You didn't get here until 9 or so.
No, I was up as soon as the alarm went off. I made a call and then walked downtown, rented another car, for Mavis this time. I don't have such good luck with Hertz.
You're going to be in trouble about that Hertz car, aren't you? Billy asked.
Nope, all's well. It could have been Harry, though. That's what the call was about, the Hertz car. I got that business associate of mine to fly back up from New York. There's a little airport in Ellsworth, and he came in there. Then the pilot hopped down to Bangor to wait for him. My associate thumbed over to Bankerton.
This thing is escalating, Billy said. You know that? It's turning into Vietnam.
Fuck no, don't be dumb, William.
Only the housekeeper flew up from New York.
Well, yeah. I don't know anyone in Maine, and the one connection I made here got his ass killed.
Anyway, there was no problem. I got a full report last night. My associate got to Bankerton around noon yesterday, and the only guy at the station was this kid who looked like he was quite a few bricks short of a full load. Kid would pump gas when someone came, but mostly he was dicking around in one of the bays, lubing a car or something. While he was in there, my friend hot-wired the Ford and drove it away. Went right past the garage bay. Kid never even turned around. My associate drove to Bangor International Airport and parked the Ford car in one of the Hertz stalls. I told him to check for bloodstains, and when I talked to him on the phone, he said he found some blood in the middle of the front seat. That was chicken blood, almost for sure. And cleaned it up with one of those wet-nap things. Then he filled in the information on the flap of the folder, dropped it into the express return box, and flew back to the Apple. What about the keys? You said he hot-wired it.
Well, Gianelli said, the keys were really the problem all along. That was another mistake. I chalk it up to short sleep, same as the other one, but maybe it really is old age creeping up. They were in Spurton's pocket, and I forgot to get them when I laid him to rest. But now,
Gianelli took out a pair of keys on a bright yellow Hertz tab. He jingled them.
Ta-da!
You went back, Billy said, his voice a little hoarse.
Good Christ! You went back and dug him up to get the keys. Well, sooner or later the woodchucks or the bears would have found them and dragged them around, Gianelli said reasonably. Or hunters would have found them. Probably in bird season when they go out with their dogs. I mean, it's no more than a minor annoyance to the Hertz people to get an express envelope without the keys. People are always forgetting to return keys to rental cars and hotel rooms. Sometimes they send them back, sometimes they don't bother. The service manager just dials an 800 number, reads off the car's VIN number, and the guy at the other end, from Ford or GM or Chrysler, gives him the key pattern. Presto, new keys. But if someone found a body in a gravel pit with a steel ball bearing in his head and a set of car keys in his pocket that could be traced to me, bad. Very bad news. You get me?
Yes.
Besides, I had to go back out there anyway, you know, Gianelli said mildly. And I couldn't go in the Nova.
Why not? They hadn't seen it.
I gotta tell it in order, William. Then you'll see. Another shot?
Billy shook his head. Gianelli helped himself.
Okay. Early Tuesday morning, the dogs. Later Tuesday morning, the Nova. Tuesday night, the heavy firepower. Wednesday morning early, the second rental car. You got all this?
I think so.
Now we're talking about a Buick sedan. The Avis guy wanted to give me an Ares K, said it was all he had left, and I was lucky to get that. But an Ares K wasn't right. Had to be a sedan. Unobtrusive, but fairly big. Took $20 to change his mind, but I finally got the car I wanted. I drove it back to the Bar Harbor Motor Inn, parked it, and made a couple more calls to make sure everything was happening the way I'd set it up. Then I drove over here in the Nova. I like that Nova, Billy. It looks like a mongrel and it smells like cow shit inside, but it's got bones. So I get here and finally set your mind at rest. By then, I'm ready to crash again, and I'm too tired to even think about going back to Bar Harbor, and I spent the whole day in your bed.
You could have called me, you know, and saved at least one trip, Billy said quietly.
Janelli smiled at him. Yeah, I could have phoned, but fuck that. A phone call wouldn't have shown me how you were, William. You haven't been the only one worried.
Billy lowered his head a little and swallowed with some difficulty, almost crying again. Lately, he was always almost crying, it seemed.
So, Janelli arises, refreshed and without too much of an amphetamine hangover. He showers, jumps into the Nova, which smells more like cow shit than ever after a day in the sun, and heads back to Bar Harbor. Once there, he takes the smaller packages out of the Nova's trunk and opens them in his room. There's a .38 Colt Woodsman and a shoulder holster in one of them. The stuff in the other two packages fits into his sport coat pockets. He then leaves the room and swaps the Nova for the Buick. He thinks for a minute that if there were two of him, he wouldn't have to spend half so much time shuffling cars like a parking lot valet at a swanky Los Angeles restaurant. Then he heads out to scenic Bankerton for what he hopes will be the last fucking time. He makes just one stop along the way, at a supermarket. He goes in and buys two things, one of those ball jars women put up preserves in, and a 16-ounce bottle of Pepsi. He arrives in Bankerton just as twilight is starting to get really deep. He drives to that gravel pit and goes right in, knowing that being coy won't make a difference at this point. If the body has been found because of the excitement last night, he's going to be in the soup anyway. But no one is there, and there are no signs that anyone has been there. So he digs down to Spurton, feels around a little, and comes up with the prize, just like in the Cracker Jack box. Janelli's voice was perfectly expressionless, but Billy found this part of it unreeling in his mind like a movie, not a particularly pleasant one. Janelli, squatting down, pushing aside the gravel with his hands, finding Spurton's shirt, his belt, his pocket, reaching in, fumbling through sandy change that would never be spent. And underneath the pocket, chilly flesh that was stiffened into rigor mortis. At last, the keys and the hasty reinterment. "Brr," Billy said and shivered. "It is all a matter of perspective, William," Janelli said calmly. "Believe me, it is."
I think that's what scared me about it, Billy thought, and then listened with growing amazement as Janelli finished the tale of his remarkable adventures.
Hertz keys in his pocket, Janelli returned to the Avis Buick. He opened the Pepsi-Cola, poured it into the ball jar, then closed the jar with the wire cap. That done, he drove up to the gypsy camp.
"I knew they'd still be there," he said. Not because they wanted to still be there, but because the state bears would have damn well told them to stay put until the investigation was over. "Here's a bunch of, well, nomads, you might as well call them. Strangers in a hick town like Bankerton, to be sure. And some other stranger or strangers come along in the middle of the night and shoot up the place. The cops tend to get interested in stuff like that." They were interested, all right. There was a Maine State Police cruiser and two unmarked Plymouths parked at the edge of the field. Janelli parked between the Plymouths, got out of his car, and started down the hill to the camp. The dead station wagon had been hauled away, presumably to a place where the crime lab people could go over it. Halfway down the hill, Janelli met a uniformed state bear headed back up.
"You don't have any business here, sir," the bear said. "You'll have to move along."
"I convinced him that I did have a spot of business there," Janelli told Billy, grinning.
"How did you do that?"
"Showed him this."
Janelli reached into his back pocket and tossed Billy a leather folder. He opened it. He knew what he was looking at immediately. He had seen a couple of these in the course of his career as a lawyer. He supposed he would have seen a lot more of them if he had specialized in criminal cases. It was a laminated FBI identification card with Janelli's picture on it.
In the photo, Cinelli looked 5 years younger. His hair was very short, almost brush-cut. The card identified him as Special Agent Ellis Stoner. Everything suddenly clicked together in Billy's mind. He looked up from the ID. You wanted the Buick because it looked more like a government car, sure. Big, unobtrusive sedan. I didn't want to show up in the rolling tuna fish can the Avis guy tried to give me, and I surely didn't want to show up in Farmer John's drive-in fuck machine. This one of the things your associate brought up on his second trip?
Yes.
Billy tossed it back. It looks almost real. Cinelli's smile faded.
Except for the picture, he said softly. It is.
For a moment there was silence as Billy tried to grope his way around that one without thinking too much about what might have happened to Special Agent Stoner, and if he might have had kids. Finally he said, You parked between two police cars and flipped that ID at a state cop 5 minutes after you finished digging a set of car keys out of a corpse's pocket in a gravel pit.
Nah,
Cinelli said.
It was more like 10.
As he made his way into the camp, he could see two guys, casually dressed but obviously cops, on their knees behind the unicorn camper. Each of them had a small garden trowel. A third stood, shining down a powerful flashlight while they dug through the earth.
Wait, wait, here's another one, one of them said.
He picked a slug out of the dirt on his trowel and dropped it into a nearby bucket.
Blonk.
Two gypsy children, obviously brothers, stood nearby watching this operation. Cinelli was actually glad the cops were there. No one knew what he looked like here, and Samuel Lemke had seen only a dark smear of lamp black. Also, it was entirely plausible that an FBI agent would show up as a result of a shooting incident featuring a Russian automatic weapon. But he had developed a deep respect for Tadus Lemke. It was more than that word written on Spurton's forehead. It was the way Lemke had stood his ground in the face of those 30-caliber bullets coming at him out of the dark. And, of course, there was the thing that was happening to William. He felt it was just possible that the old man might know who he was. He might see it in Ginelli's eyes, or smell it on his skin somehow. Under no circumstances did he intend to let the old man with the rotten nose touch him. It was the girl he wanted. He crossed the inner circle and knocked on the door of one of the campers at random. He had to knock again before it was opened by a middle-aged woman with frightened, distrustful eyes.
"Whatever you want, we haven't got it for you," she said. "We've got troubles here. We are closed. Sorry."
Cinelli flashed the folder. "Special Agent Stoner, ma'am. FBI." Her eyes widened. She crossed herself rapidly and said something in Romani. Then she said,
"Oh, God, what next? Nothing is right anymore. Since Susanna died, it's like we've been cursed, or..."
She was pushed aside by her husband, who told her to shut up. "Special Agent Stoner," Cinelli began again.
"Yes, I heard what you said."
He worked his way out. Cinelli guessed he was 45, but he looked older, an extremely tall man who slumped so badly that he looked almost deformed. He wore a Disney World T-shirt and huge baggy Bermuda shorts. He smelled of Thunderbird wine and vomit waiting to happen. He looked like the sort of man to whom it happened fairly often, like 3 and 4 times a week. Cinelli thought he recognized him from the night before. It had either been this guy or there was another gypsy around here who went 6'4", 6'5". He had been one of those bounding away with all the grace of a blind epileptic having a heart attack, he told Billy.
"What do you want? We've had cops on our asses all day. We always got cops on our asses, but this is just fucking ridiculous."
He spoke in an ugly, hectoring tone, and his wife spoke to him agitatedly in Rom. He turned his head toward her.
"That Kriska, Janghaler," he said, and added for good measure, "Shut up, bitch!"
The woman retreated, The man in the Disney shirt turned back to Ginelli.
What do you want? Why did you go talk to your buddies if you want something?
He nodded toward the crime lab people.
Could I have your name, please?
Ginelli asked, with the same blank-faced politeness.
Why don't you get it from them?
He crossed slabby, flabby arms truculently. Under his shirt, his large breasts jiggled.
We gave them our names. We gave them our statements. Someone took a few shots at us in the middle of the night. That's all any of us know. We just want to be let loose. We want to get out of Maine, out of New England, off the fucking East Coast.
In a slightly lower voice, he added,
And never come back.
The index and pinky fingers of his left hand popped out in a gesture Ginelli knew well from his mother and grandmother. It was the sign against the evil eye. He didn't believe the man was even aware he had done it.
This can go one of two ways, Ginelli said, still playing the ultra-polite FBI man to the hilt. You can give me a bit of information, sir, or you can end up in the state detention center, pending a recommendation on whether or not to charge you with the obstruction of justice. If convicted of obstruction, you would face 5 years in jail and a fine of $5,000.
Another flood of rum from the camper, this one nearly hysterical.
Enkelt!
The man yelled hoarsely, but when he turned back to Ginelli again, his face had paled noticeably.
You are nuts.
No, sir, Ginelli said. It wasn't a matter of a few shots. It was at least three bursts fired from an automatic rifle. Private ownership of machine guns and rapid-fire automatic weapons is against the law in the United States. The FBI is involved in this case, and I must sincerely advise you that you are currently waist-deep in shit. It's getting deeper, and I don't think you know how to swim.
The man looked at him sullenly for a moment longer and then said,
My name's Heilig. Trey Heilig. You could have gotten it from those guys.
He nodded.
They've got their jobs to do. I've got mine. No. Are you going to talk to me?
The big man nodded resignedly. He put Trey Heilig through an account of what had happened the night before. Halfway through it, one of the state detectives wandered over to see who he was. He glanced at Ginelli's ID and then left quickly, looking both impressed and a little worried. Heilig claimed he had burst out of his camper at the sound of the first shots, had spotted the gun flashes, and had headed up the hill to the left, hoping to flank the shooter. But in the dark, he had stumbled over a tree or something, hit his head on a rock, and blacked out for a while. Otherwise, he surely would have had the bastard. In support of his story, he pointed to a fading bruise, at least 3 days old, and probably incurred in a drunken stumble, and his left temple.
Uh-huh, Ginelli thought,
and turned to another page in his notebook. Enough of the hocus-pocus. It was time to get down to business.
Thank you very much, Mr. Heilig. You've been a great help.
Telling the tale seemed to have mollified the man.
Well, that's okay. I'm sorry I jumped on you like that. But if you were us...
He shrugged.
Cops, his wife said from behind him.
She was looking out the door of the camper like a very old, very tired badger, looking out of her hole to see how many dogs are around and how vicious they look.
Always cops wherever we go. That's usual. But this is worse. People are scared.
Enkelt, mama,
Heilig said, but more gently now.
I've got to talk to two more people if you can direct me, he said, and looked at a blank page in his notebook. Mr. Tadus Lemke and a Mrs. Angelina Lemke.
Tadus is asleep in there, Heilig said,
and pointed at the unicorn camper. Ginelli found this to be excellent news indeed, if it was true.
He's very old, and all of this has tired him out real bad. I think Gina's in her camper over there. She ain't a missus, though.
He pointed a dirty finger at a small green Toyota with a neat wooden cap on the back.
Thank you very much.
He closed the notebook and tucked it into his back pocket. Heilig retreated to his camper, and his bottle, presumably, looking relieved. Janelli walked across the inner circle again in the growing gloom, this time to the girl's camper. His heart, he told Billy, was beating high and hard and fast. He drew a deep breath and knocked on the door. There was no immediate answer. He was raising his hand to knock again when it was opened. William had said she was lovely, but he was not prepared for the depth of her loveliness, the dark, direct eyes with corneas so white they were faintly bluish, the clean olive skin that glowed faintly pink deep down. He looked for a moment at her hands and saw that they were strong and corded. There was no polish on the nails, which were clean but clipped as bluntly close as the fingernails of a farmer. In one of those hands she held a book called Statistical Sociology.
"Yes?"
"Special Agent Ellis Stoner, Miss Lemke," he said, and immediately that clear, lucent quality left her eyes. It was as if a shutter had fallen over them. "FBI."
"Yes?"
she repeated, but with no more life than a telephone answering machine. "We're investigating the shooting incident that took place here last night."
"You and half the world," she said. "Well, investigate away. But if I don't get my correspondence course lessons in the mail by tomorrow morning, I'm going to get grades taken off for lateness. So, if you'll excuse me..."
"We've reason to believe that a man named William Halleck may have been behind it," Janelli said. "Does that name mean anything to you?" Of course it did. For a moment, her eyes opened wide and simply blazed. Janelli had thought her lovely almost beyond believing. He still did. But he now also believed this girl really could have been the one who killed Frank Spurton.
"That pig," she spat. "Han sat a sick pa in af stornarna. Han snig lade pa nyet mot hilnya I wild, wild."
"I have a number of pictures of a man we believe to be Halleck," Janelli said mildly. "They were taken in Bar Harbor by an agent using a telephoto lens."
"Of course it's Halleck," she said. "That pig killed my Tante Nied, my grandmother. But he won't bother us long. He..."
She bit her full lower lip, bit it hard, and stopped the words. If Janelli had been the man he was claiming to be, she would already have assured herself of an extremely deep and detailed interrogation. Janelli, however, affected not to notice. "In one of the photographs, money appears to be passing between the two men. If one of the men is Halleck, then the other one is probably the shooter who visited your camp last night. I'd like you and your grandfather to identify Halleck positively, if you can."
"He's my great-grandfather," she said absently. "I think he's asleep. My brother is with him. I hate to wake him."
She paused.
"I hate to upset him with this. The last few days have been dreadfully hard on him."
"Well, suppose we do this," Janelli said. "You look through the photos, and if you can positively identify the man as Halleck, we won't need to bother the elder Mr. Lemke."
"That would be fine. If you catch this Halleck pig, you will arrest him?"
"Oh, yes. I have a federal John Doe warrant with me." That convinced her. As she swung out of the camper with a swirl of skirt and a heartbreaking flash of tanned leg, she said something that chilled Janelli's heart.
"There won't be much of him to arrest, I don't think."
They walked past the cops, still sifting dirt in the deepening gloom. They passed several gypsies, including the two brothers, now dressed for bed in identical pairs of camouflage pajamas. Gina nodded at several of them, and they nodded back, but steered clear. The tall, Italian-looking man with Gina was FBI, and it was best not to meddle into such business. They passed out of the circle and walked up the hill toward Janelli's car, and the evening shadows swallowed them.
"It was just as easy as pie, William," Janelli said. "Third night in a row, and it was still as easy as pie.
Why not? The place was crawling with cops. Was the guy who shot them up just going to come back and do something else while the cops were there? They didn't think so. But they were stupid, William. I expected it of the rest of them, but not of the old man. You don't spend your whole life learning how to hate and distrust the cops, and then just suddenly decide they're going to protect you from whoever has been biting on your ass. But the old man was sleeping. He's worn out. That's good. We may just take him, William. We may just. They walked back to the Buick. Ginelli opened the driver's side door while the girl stood there. And as he leaned in, taking the .38 out of the shoulder holster with one hand and pushing the wire lid holder off the ball jar with the other, he felt the girl's mood abruptly change from bitter exultation to one of sudden wariness. Ginelli himself was pumped up. His emotions and intuitions turned outward and tuned to an almost exquisite degree. He seemed to sense her first awareness of the crickets, the surrounding darkness, the ease with which she had been split off from the others by a man she had never seen before, at a time when she should have known better than to trust any man she had never seen before. For the first time, she was wondering why Ellis Stoner hadn't brought the papers down to the camp with him if he was so hot to get an ID on Halleck. But it was all too late. He had mentioned the one name guaranteed to cause a knee-jerk spasm and hate and to blind her with eagerness. "Here we are," Ginelli said, and turned back to her with the gun in one hand and the glass ball jar in the other. Her eyes widened again. Her breasts heaved as she opened her mouth and drew in breath. "You can start to scream," Ginelli said. "But I guarantee it will be the last sound you ever hear yourself make, Gina." For a moment, he thought she would do it anyway. And then she let the breath out in a long sigh. "You're the one working with that pig," she said. "Hansate Sigpa." "Talk English, whore," he said almost casually, and she recoiled as if slapped. "You don't call me a whore," she whispered. "No one is going to call me a whore." Her hands, those strong hands, arched and hooked into claws. "You call my friend William a pig. I call you a whore, your mother a whore, your father an asshole-licking toilet hound," Ginelli said. He saw her lips draw back from her teeth in a snarl, and he grinned. Something in that grin made her falter. She did not exactly look afraid. Ginelli told Billy later that he wasn't sure then if it was in her to look afraid. But some reason seemed to surface through her hot fury, some sense of who and what she was dealing with. "What do you think this is, a game?" he asked. "You throw a curse onto someone with a wife and a kid. You think it's a game? You think he hit that woman, your grandma, on purpose? You think he had a contract on her? You think the mafia had a contract put on your old grandmother? Shit." The girl was now crying with rage and hate.
"He was getting a jerk-off job from his woman, and he ran her down in the street. And then they Hantog and Poikin whitewash him off. But we got him fixed, and you will be next, you friend of pigs. It doesn't matter what."
He pushed the glass cap off the top of the wide-mouthed jar with his thumb. Her eyes went to the jar for the first time. That was just where he wanted them. "Acid whore," Ginelli said, and threw it in her face. "See how many people you shoot with that slingshot of yours when you're blind." She made a high, windy, screeching sound and clapped her hands over her eyes too late. She fell to the ground. Ginelli put a foot on her neck. "You scream and I'll kill you. You and the first three of your friends to make it up here." He took the foot away. "It was Pepsi Cola." She got to her knees, staring at him through her spread fingers, and with those same exquisitely tuned, almost telepathic senses, Ginelli knew that she hadn't needed him to tell her it wasn't acid. She knew, had almost known at once in spite of the stinging. An instant later, barely in time, he knew she was going to go for his balls. As she sprang at him, smooth as a cat, he sidestepped and kicked her in the side. The back of her head struck the chrome edging of the open driver's side door with a loud crunch, and she fell in a heap, blood flowing down one flawless cheek. Janelli bent toward her, sure she was unconscious, and she was at him, hissing. One hand tore across his forehead, opening a long cut there. The other ripped through the arm of his turtleneck and drew more blood. Janelli snarled and pushed her back down. He jammed the pistol against her nose. "Come on, you want to go for it? You want it? Go for it, whore. Go on. You spoiled my face. I'd love for you to go for it." She lay still, staring at him with eyes now as dark as death. "You'd do it," he said. "If it was just you, you'd come at me again. But it would just about kill him, wouldn't it? The old man." She said nothing, but a dim light seemed to flicker momentarily across the darkness of those eyes. "Well, you think what it would do to him if that really had been acid I threw in your face. Think what it would do to him if instead of you, I decided to throw it in the faces of those two kids in the G.I. Joe pajamas. I could do it, whore. I could do it and then go back home and eat a good dinner. You look into my face, and you are gonna know I could." Now at last he saw confusion and a dawning of something that could have been fear, but not for herself. "He cursed you," he said. "I was the curse." "Fuck, he's cursed, that pig," she whispered, and wiped blood from her face with a contemptuous flick of her fingers. "He tells me not to hurt anyone," Janelli went on, as if she had not spoken. "I haven't. But that ends tonight. I don't know how many times your old Gramps has gotten away with this before, but he ain't gonna get away with it this time. You tell him to take it off. You tell him it's the last time I ask. Here, take this." He pressed a scrap of paper into her hand. On it, he had written the telephone number of the safe kiosk in New York. "You're going to call this number by midnight tonight and tell me what that old man says. If you need to hear back from me, you call that number again 2 hours later. You can pick up your message, if there is one. And that's it. One way or another, the door is going to be closed. No one at that number is going to know what the fuck you are talking about after 2 o'clock tomorrow morning."
"He'll never take it off."
"Well, maybe he won't," he said. "Because that is the same thing your brother said last night. But that's not your business. You just play square with him and let him make up his own mind what he's going to do. Make sure you explain to him that if he says no, that's when the boogie-woogie really starts. You go first, then the two kids, then anybody else I can get my hands on. Tell him that. Now get in the car."
"No."
Janelli rolled his eyes. "Will you wise up? I just want to make sure I have time to get out of here without 12 cops in my tail. If I had wanted to kill you, I wouldn't have given you a message to deliver." The girl got up. She was a little wobbly, but she made it. She got in behind the wheel and then slid across the seat. Not far enough. Janelli wiped blood off his forehead and showed it to her on his fingers. "After this, I want to see you crouched up against that door over there like a wallflower on her first date." She slid against the door. "Good," Janelli said, getting in. "Now stay there." He backed out to Finson Road without turning on his lights. The Buick's wheels spun a little on the dry timothy grass. He shifted to drive with his gun hand, saw her twitch, and pointed the gun at her again. "Wrong," he said. "Don't move. Don't move at all. You understand?"
"I understand."
"Good." He drove back the way he had come, holding the gun on her.
"Always it's this way," she said bitterly. "For even a little justice, we are asked to pay so much. He is your friend, this pig, Halleck?"
"I told you, don't call him that. He's no pig."
"He cursed us," she said. There was a kind of wondering contempt in her voice. "Tell him for me, mister, that God cursed us long before him or any of his tribe ever were."
"Save it for the social worker, babe." She fell silent. A quarter of a mile before the gravel pit where Frank Spurton rested, Janelli stopped the car. Okay. This is far enough. Get out.
Sure.
She looked at him steadily with those unfathomable eyes.
But there is one thing you should know, mister. Our paths will cross again. And when they do, I will kill you.
No, he said. You won't. Because you owe me your life tonight. And if that ain't enough for you, you ungrateful bitch, you can add in your brother's life last night. You talk, but you still don't understand the way things are, or why you ain't home free on this, or why you ain't never gonna be home free on this until you quit. I got a friend who could fly like a kite if you hooked up some twine to his belt. What have you got? I'll tell you what you got. You got an old man with no nose who put a curse on my friend and then ran away in the night like a hyena. Now she was crying and crying hard. The tears ran down her face in streams.
Are you saying God is on your side? She asked him,
her voice so thick the words were almost unintelligible.
Is that what I hear you saying? You should burn in hell for such blasphemy. Are we hyenas? If we are, it was people like your friend who made us so. My great-grandfather says there are no curses, only mirrors you hold up to the souls of men and women.
Get out, he said. We can't talk. We can't even hear each other.
That's right.
She opened the door and got out. As he pulled away, she screamed,
Your friend is a pig, and he'll die thin.
But I don't think you will, Ginelli said.
What do you mean?
Ginelli looked at his watch. It was after 3 o'clock. Tell you in the car, he said. You've got an appointment at 7 o'clock.
Billy felt that sharp, hollow needle of fear in his belly again.
With him?
That's right. Let's go.
As Billy got to his feet, there was another arrhythmic episode, this the longest one yet. He closed his eyes and grasped at his chest, what remained of his chest. Ginelli grabbed him.
William, are you okay?
He looked in the mirror and saw Ginelli holding a grotesque sideshow freak in flapping clothes. The arrhythmia passed and was replaced by an even more familiar sensation, that milky, curdled rage that was directed at the old man and at Heidi.
I'm okay, he said. Where are we going?
Bangor, Ginelli said. They took the Nova. Both things Ginelli had told him about it were true. It smelled quite strongly of cow manure, and it ate the road between Northeast Harbor and Bangor in great swallows. Ginelli stopped around 4 to pick up a huge basket of steamer clams. They parked at a roadside rest area and divided them, along with a 6-pack of beer. The 2 or 3 family groups at the picnic tables got a look at Billy Halleck and moved as far away as possible. While they ate, Ginelli finished his story. It didn't take long. I was back in the John Tree room by 11 o'clock last night, he said. I could have gotten there quicker, maybe, but I did a few loops and figure eights and turnbacks just to make sure no one was behind me. Once I was in the room, I called New York and sent a fellow out to the telephone I gave the girl the number for. I told him to take a tape deck and a steno plug with him, the kind of gadget reporters use to do phone interviews. I didn't want to have to rely on hearsay, William, if you can dig that. I told him to call me back with the tape as soon as she hung up. I disinfected the cut she put on me while I waited for the call back. I'm not going to say she had hydrophobia or anything like that, William, but there was so much hate in her, you know.
I know, Billy said, and thought grimly. I really do know. Because I'm gaining. In that one way, I'm gaining.
The call had come at 12:15. Closing his eyes and pressing the fingers of his left hand against his forehead, Ginelli was able to give Billy an almost exact recitation of how the playback had gone. Ginelli's man.
Hello?
Gina Lemke.
Do you work for the man I saw tonight?
Ginelli's man.
Yes, you could say that.
Gina.
Tell him my great-grandfather says...
Janelli's man. I got a steno plug on this. I mean, you are being taped. I will play it back for the man you mentioned. So?
Gina. You can do that?
Janelli's man.
Yes.
So you are talking to him now in a way of speaking.
Gina. All right. My great-grandfather says he will take it off. I tell him he is crazy, worse, that he is wrong, but he is firm. He says there can be no more hurting and no more fear for his people. He will take it off. But he needs to meet with Halleck. He can't take it off unless he does. At 7 o'clock tomorrow evening, my great-grandfather will be in Bangor. There is a park between two streets, Union and Hammond. He will be there, sitting on a bench. He will be alone.
So you win, big man. You win, Mihela Poklokin. Have your pig friend in Fairmont Park, Bangor, tonight at 7.
Janelli's man. That's all?
Gina.
Yes, except you tell him, I hope his cock turns black and falls off.
Janelli's man.
You're telling him yourself, sister. But you wouldn't be if you knew who you was telling.
Gina.
And fuck you, too.
Janelli's man.
You should call back here at 2 to see if there's an answer.
Gina.
I'll call.
She hung up, Janelli said. He dumped the empty clamshells in a litter basket, came back, and added with no pity at all. My guy said it sounded like she was crying all the way through it.
Christ Jesus, Billy muttered.
Anyway, I had my guy put the steno plug back on the phone, and I recorded a message for him to play back to her when she called at 2. It went like this. Hello, Gina. This is Special Agent Stoner. I have your message. It sounds like a go. My friend William will come to the park at 7 o'clock this evening. He will be alone, but I will be watching. Your people will be watching too, I imagine. That's fine. Let's us both watch, and let neither of us get in the way of what goes on between the two of them. If anything happens to my friend, you will pay a high price.
And that was it?
Yes, that was it.
The old man caved in.
I think he caved in. It could still be a trap, you know.
Janelli looked at him soberly.
They know I'll be watching. They may have decided to kill you where I can see it, as revenge on me, and then take their chances with what happens next.
They're killing me anyway, Billy said.
Or the girl could take it into her head to do it on her own. She's mad, William. People don't always do what they're told when they're mad.
Billy looked at him reflectively.
No, they don't. But either way, I don't have much choice, do I?
No, I don't think you do. You ready?
Billy glanced toward the people staring at him and nodded. He'd been ready for a long time.
Halfway back to the car, he said,
Did you really do any of it for me, Richard?
Janelli stopped, looked at him, and smiled a little. The smile was almost vague, but that whirling, twirling light in his eyes was sharply focused, too sharply focused for Billy to look at. He had to shift his gaze.
Does it matter, William?
They were in Bangor by late afternoon. Janelli swung the Nova into a gas station, had it filled up, and got directions from the attendant. Billy sat exhaustedly in the passenger seat. Janelli looked at him with sharp concern when he came back.
William, are you all right?
I don't know, he said, and then reconsidered.
No.
Is it your ticker again?
Yeah.
He thought about what Ginelli's midnight doctor had said. Potassium, electrolytes, something about how Karen Carpenter might have died. I ought to have something with potassium in it. Pineapple juice, bananas, or oranges. His heart broke into a sudden, disorganized gallop. Billy leaned back and shut his eyes and waited to see if he was going to die. At last, the uproar quieted. A whole bag of oranges. There was a Shop and Save up ahead. Ginelli pulled in.
I'll be right back, William. Hang in.
Sure, Billy said vaguely, and fell into a light doze as soon as Ginelli left the car. He dreamed. In his dream, he saw his house in Fairview. A vulture with a rotting beak flew down to the windowsill and peered in. From inside the house, someone began to shriek. Then someone else was shaking him roughly. Billy started awake.
Huh?
Ginelli leaned back and blew out breath.
Jesus, William, don't scare me like that.
What are you talking about?
I thought you were dead, man. Here.
He put a net bag filled with navel oranges in Billy's lap. Billy plucked at the fastener with his thin fingers, fingers which now looked like white spider legs, and couldn't get it to give. Ginelli slit the bag open with his pocket knife, then cut an orange in quarters with it. Billy ate slowly at first, as one does a duty, then ravenously, seeming to rediscover his appetite for the first time in a week or more. And his disturbed heart seemed to calm down and rediscover something like its old, steady beat, although that might have been only his mind playing games with itself. He finished the first orange and borrowed Ginelli's knife to cut a second one into pieces.
Better?
Ginelli asked. Yes, a lot. When do we get to the park? Ginelli pulled over to the curb, and Billy saw by the sign that they were on the corner of Union Street and West Broadway. Summer trees, full of foliage, murmured in a mild breeze. Dapples and shadow moved lazily on the street.
We're here, Ginelli said simply,
and Billy felt a finger touch his backbone and then slide coldly down it.
As close as I want to get, anyway.
I would have dropped you off downtown, only you would have attracted one hell of a lot of attention walking up here.
Yes, Billy said, like children fainting and pregnant women having miscarriages. You couldn't have made it anyway, Ginelli said kindly. Anyway, it don't matter. Park's right down at the foot of this hill, quarter of a mile. Pick a bench in the shade and wait.
Where will you be?
I'll be around, Ginelli said and smiled. Watching you and watching out for the girl. If she ever sees me again before I see her, William, I ain't never gonna have to change my shirt again. You understand?
Yes.
I'll be keeping my eye on you.
Thank you, Billy said, and was not sure just how or how much he meant that. He did feel gratitude to Ginelli, but it was a strange, difficult emotion, like the hate he now bore for Houston and his wife.
Por nada, Ginelli said and shrugged.
He leaned across the seat, hugged Billy, and kissed him firmly on both cheeks.
Be tough with the old bastard, William.
I will, Billy said, smiling, and got out of the car. The dented Nova pulled away. Billy stood watching until it had disappeared around the corner at the end of the block, and then he started down the hill, swinging the bag of oranges in one hand. He barely noticed the little boy who, halfway up the block, abruptly turned off the sidewalk, scaled the Cowan's fence, and shot across their backyard. That night, this little boy would awake screaming from a nightmare in which a shambling scarecrow with lifeless blowing hair on its skull head bore down on him. Running down the hallway to his room, the boy's mother heard him screaming,
"It wants to make me eat oranges until I die. Eat oranges till I die. Eat till I die."
The park was wide and cool and green and deep. On one side, a gaggle of kids were variously climbing on the jungle gym, teeter-tottering, and whooshing down the slide. Far across the way, a softball game was going on,
the boys against the girls, it looked like. In between, people walked, flew kites, threw frisbees, ate Twinkies, drank Cokes, slurped Slurpees. It was a cameo of American Midsummer in the latter half of the 20th century, and for a moment, Billy warmed toward it. Toward them. "All that's lacking is the gypsies," a voice inside him whispered, and the chill came back. A chill real enough to bring goosebumps to his arms, and cause him to abruptly cross his thin arms over his reed of a chest. "We ought to have gypsies, oughtn't we? The old station wagons with the NRA stickers on the rusty bumpers, the campers, the vans with the murals on the sides. Then Samuel with his bowling pins and Gina with her slingshot. And they all came running. They always came running. To see the juggling, to try the slingshot, to hear the future, to get a potion or a lotion, to bet a girl, or at least to dream of it, to see the dogs tear at each other's guts. They always come running, just for the strangeness of it. Sure, we need the gypsies. We always have. Because if you don't have someone to run out of town once in a while, how are you going to know you yourself belong there? Well, they'll be along soon, right? Right, he croaked, and sat down on a bench that was almost in the shade. His legs were suddenly trembling, strengthless. He took an orange out of the bag, and after some effort, managed to tear it open. But now his appetite was gone again, and he could only eat a little. The bench was quite a distance apart from the others, and Billy attracted no undue attention, so far as he could tell. From a distance, he could have been a very thin old man, taking in a little afternoon air. He sat, and as the shade crept up first over his shoes, then his knees, and finally puddled in his lap, an almost fantastical sense of despair overtook him, a feeling of waste and futility much darker than these innocent afternoon shadows. Things had gone too far, and nothing could be taken back. Not even Ginelli, with his psychotic energy, could change what had happened. He could only make things worse. I should have never, Billy thought, but then, whatever it was he should have never done, broke up and faded out like a bad radio signal. He dozed again. He was in Fairview, a fair